Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with one of the editors of We Are Strong, Wartime Origins and the Future United Nations. I'll be talking with Tom Weiss, who's one of the editors, along with Dan Plesch. I hope that you enjoy this interview that I did with Tom. Welcome back to the podcast. As I mentioned, I have the real pleasure to talk to Thomas Weiss, who's one of the editors of We Are Strong, Wartime Origins and the Future United Nations, published by Routledge Press. Tom, how are you doing today?
Pretty well, thanks, Heath.
Tom, it's a pleasure to have you on. Before we get to the book, why don't you tell those that don't know who you are, I know who you are, but tell us a little bit about yourself and then also your co-editor, Dan Plesch.
Well, I've been at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York teaching international relations for the last 17 years, and for 16 of those, I directed the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies. During that time, I drew upon my previous existence in life as an international official. I lived and worked in Geneva, but I've always been interested in the behavior and misbehavior of international institutions, more specifically the United Nations. And my current interest focus on both my efforts as a back-of-the-envelope historian, looking back at World War II and earlier the intellectual history of the United Nations, and also looking at the future of shape of the so-called UN system. Dan is the director of the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy at SOAS of the University of London. He's more properly a historian and has written actually on the period treated by this book from 1942 to 1945, the origins during World War II of this beast that we now call the United Nations.
Yeah, one of the nice things about the podcast is that the historians get to play political scientists and the political scientists get to play sociologists, and there's the type of intermingling that we all talk about, and I think this book shows some of that interdisciplinary flair to the study of the UN. Before we get to what this book is about, this book fits into a series. Would you talk a little bit about the larger series, how long it's been published, and where this volume fits into the series?
Well, that's kind. Little station identification never hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Rorden Wilkinson, who is now at the University of Sussex as the chair of the International Relations Department there, and I have edited this series called Global Institutions since 2005, and actually next week at the International Studies Association's annual meeting, there will be a reception to celebrate the 100th volume in the series. The series has three tracks, really. What we see is a short and authoritative treatment by experts of particular institutions, the Security Council, the General Assembly, the OECD, the African Union, and it goes on and on. There is a forthcoming stream, which will be on theory, everything you wanted to know and were afraid to ask about constructivism or realism will be brought to you in short form, around 40 or 50,000 words, by people who know those topics inside out. And the final stream, if you will, is the red stream in which this book appears, which are longer, usually 75 to 80,000 words, treatments of specialized research topics. Some of these are single-authored. Some of them are edited, like the one that we're discussing today.
It's and I have one of my former colleagues, Martin Edwards. I hope a listener is somebody who's written this series, and just I haven't seen others, but they do look interesting in terms of their topics.
Well, it's
like
also, if I may, one thing I probably
Please.
Should say is that when I talk with my own mentor, who's now 91 years old, he sort of is envious. I in scare quotes, he's not really envious, but he says it's really interesting to see that in the year 2005, when the series started, and even today, that publishers are actually interested in intergovernmental and non-governmental and every other kind of institution, that there is a market for such books, as I mentioned, 100 of them today, that there was not necessarily for a very long period of time. Immediately after the Second World War, lots of institutions grew up. There was a real, there were six people at Columbia teaching on the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And then in the 60s and 70s, the whole notion of institutions, qua institutions, actually kind of disappeared as these institutions fell into sort of, I'm not going to say disarray or disrepair, but states moved in other directions, and analysts also moved in the direction of softer stuff, and in the 1990s, global governance. But we are now realizing that actually well-structured, effective, and that's not always the case, things that you can see and feel and touch and go to, organizations, are very a necessary part of global governance. Not the only part, but a big part.
Yeah, and you write in the introduction, you two write the introduction to the book, you write, and let me quote, "Today, a key question that ought to be in boldface type on the agenda of global governance is, do we need another cataclysm to rekindle the imagination and energy and cooperation that was in the air in the 1940s, or are we smart enough to adapt in anticipation?" Would you expand a little bit on this statement for us? It seems to really strike the heart of what many in the book are writing about.
Well, let me start by saying that I hope the answer to that question is the second half of the book.
Right.
That maybe we'll wake up. Although, as I look around and sort of examine what's happening with climate change or sort of the half-hearted efforts at Ebola or nuclear proliferation or terrorism or international finance, there's not a whole lot of evidence that we're smart enough. I keep hoping, and that's the business that you and I are in, that maybe things like knowledge, facts, and history may help take the necessary steps. But what fascinated us about this period, the last great world conflict, was the fact that during this period, 1942 to 1945, the term United Nations, which Roosevelt came up with and gave to Churchill, who was taking a bath. I sort of quite imagine this scene, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But the United Nations was an alliance of 44 countries at the outset that was necessary to defeat fascism. But at the same time, it was also a commitment to multilateral cooperation as a kind of a standard bill of fare, as a way of operating. And it also was part of a vision about post-war peace and prosperity. All of that grew from the Second War within a generation. Second War in 20 years, Second War to end all wars. And as a result, during this period, and the results, I think people don't always recall that the victory of the Allies was not a done deal. It was hardly a foregone conclusion. So that in the midst of this conflagration, with London under siege, with the United States scrambling to replace all the airplanes that had been destroyed at Pearl Harbor, that in the midst of this tumult and real crisis in the future existence of the West as we know it, that at the same time there were a huge number of people who spent a lot of time and energy, including Roosevelt and Churchill, but other world leaders as well, looking at what had happened to the predecessor, the League of Nations, which had, for a whole variety of reasons, including the absence of the United States and Germany and Russia, led to the Second World War, the absence of institutions to deal with trade and finance that led to the Great Depression, etc. So that part of what was going on during this period was not just increasing the capacity of industry to produce airplanes and tanks and armaments of various sorts, but it also was a devotion to thinking about what had worked less well during the previous system. So while everyone agreed that the League had failed, the answer was not to chuck this into the dustbin of history, but to build upon it and do something better the next time. And under the pressure of really World War II and our backs against the wall, or certainly Britain's back was against the wall, and lots of Europe, the United States, not quite, that a significant amount of resources, intellectual and some financial ones, were devoted to thinking and thinking big about the post-war era and the peace and prosperity that everyone hoped would follow.
Yeah, I was particularly drawn to chapter 3 of the book, and the chapter is about in the midst of World War II, you know, in the darkest days, that planners conceived of an educational institution as critical for future world peace. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit? You sort of just alluded to some of this, but would you talk to us a little bit about that chapter and the creation of what later became UNESCO?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, one could have imagined that the kind of education that might have been replicated by the victors, who were not yet victors, but the Allies, would have been a Nazi education on steroids or something. Mm-hmm. That we ought to militarize education and teach everyone to be a nationalist in order to face the extraordinary threat that was Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. But that was not the notion that was discussed by the Allied ministers of education. Their focus was instead on the basis for, let's use the word, peace, was in fact in the minds of men, and now we'd say men and women, and that educational processes had to reflect the need for the kinds of things that roll off our tongue, tolerance and openness and willingness to think about how differences didn't need to become chasms between and among peoples. So that, as I say, during London, under siege, you have several meetings of the Allied ministers of education talking about what needed to come next. What kinds of education, what kinds of restoration of archives, and what kinds of books, and et cetera, would need to be available at the end of the conflict. And so that's a kind of a reflection of a vision. And I think one ought to not be afraid of the word, of a vision about the post-war world. Now, obviously, that vision came apart very quickly, and the reason that we asked the question about another world war, or whether we can learn lessons, is that immediately, and almost probably even before the end of the war in August of 45, these visions were already receding because of the renewed hostility between East and West, the Soviet Union and the United States, so that these visions about a post-war were about what was necessary, about how to take a step beyond what had happened in 1918, suddenly were set aside in a very big hurry, including education and war crimes and refugees and the entire works that we looked at in this book. So the reason that we started this entire project and that the Carnegie Corporation financed was, why is it under these circumstances? You know, what are the conditions under which states occasionally move out of their standard operating procedures of only me first, only my population first, and narrowly defined national interests. And it obviously, under the pressure of war, these kinds of experiments and this kind of thinking moves ahead. I think it's the best example, if we're thinking about international finance. At the meeting in Bretton Woods, arguably the world's best economist in the 20th century, John Maynard might not agree, but, you know, John Maynard Keynes was well-respected everywhere. And when he arrived at Bretton Woods, his notion about a stabilization fund, it was not yet called the International Monetary Fund, but he thought that there should be international resources, we now call them special drawing rights, but international resources set aside that would be the equivalent of 50% of the world's imports. Harry Dexter White, the American head of delegation, said, "Oh my God, you know, this is wild. You can't mm-hmm. you can't do anything like that." He said, "How about 15%?" Well, the all-powerful International Monetary Fund, which comes under criticism for, you know, throwing its weight around, et cetera, has never had more than about 1.5% under its authority. So here, if you want to compare the vision, the sort of thinking during the war about what kinds of institutions would be adequate to the task, with the sort of mice that have been hatched subsequently, you see what happens, I think, under the pressure of war, and why we ask that question, not totally rhetorically, is this what's necessary to get states to do something about climate change? Is this what's necessary to stop pandemics or proliferation? We hope not, but the common currency of reform, international reform, is usually cataclysms.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about reform. You write in the book that present policy needs to be better informed by history, much of the history that you've been describing so far. So how is the UN learning from its past? The chapter by Burley and Brown talks about the status of system-wide reform. Where do we stand today on the future of the UN? Are there any particular proposals out there that do justice to the detailed history that you in many ways are calling upon? When can we look to for the overhaul that some people have called for? Perhaps an overhaul isn't necessary. But where do we stand on reform?
No, I think that. I would use the word transformation, not even change or reform of the system, is urgently required, but is nowhere, and I mean nowhere, on the agenda of states, and certainly nowhere on the agenda of the Secretary General or any senior officials or heads of other specialized agencies. You know, business as usual and inertia are the usual explanations for how we proceed. In this other project that I mentioned briefly, the Future United Nations Development System, we've been looking at the history of reform, and two months ago in December, we bring out a monthly publication called Briefing on a specific topic. And the one in December was written by Margaret Joan Anstey, Dame Margaret, who's in her 90s, but who wrote about 45 years of unsuccessful efforts to change. We're not talking about the Security Council. She wrote only about the United Nations Development System, this sort of totally atomized, totally decentralized set of institutions, at least 30, maybe 70, depending on which ones and which funds and programs you throw into it, all of which are part of the so-called system, but none of which really works together. They all have separate budgets. They all have separate cultures. They all go their own ways. They all compete for resources. And rather than pulling together, they compete. She and Sir Robert Jackson wrote a report in 1969 that, frankly, looks very sensible today, and on which no progress has been made in 45 years. So I dare say that if you were betting, inertia is what explains what happens and what's happened in the United Nations in particular over the last 70 years, because this year we're celebrating may not be the right word, but anyway, we are in the midst of the 70th anniversary of the gathering in San Francisco to put together the system to come up with the United Nations Charter, and then the 70th anniversary in October of the entry into force. And here we are with states quite happy, I think, to let things slide. And that's why we keep going back to that question that you started the interview off with. What actually is necessary to budge this monster, which is controlled by states? You know, it's not just the staff who work at the United Nations who are responsible for this, but it's mainly the member states who pay the bills, or sometimes pay the bills, that are responsible here. So that's where we are.
Right. So if we can't look forward to change the UN, what might we look forward to in this series? Let's talk about something that we may have a little more control over and that we can hedge our bets on. So what's up next? Do you have the next book that's going to come out? What can we look for in the future from the series?
Well, I suspect that much of the emphasis among analysts and of international relations these days, and one of my main gripes, shall we say, is the emphasis that is placed on everything except intergovernmental organizations. So what started in 1945 as the centerpiece, as the backbone of post-war order, has now been relegated to the margins because of their structures, because of the perceived ineffectiveness, and the list goes on. And now we are all, and I put myself in this category as well, having established a journal called Global Governance, interested in sort of describing the complex lattice work of other kinds of institutions, non-governmental organizations, every element of civil society, all kinds of transnational corporations. The literature is filled with human rights activists crossing borders, and the list goes on. And while I agree that this complex nature of contemporary international society, it consists of lots of things besides intergovernmental organizations, I think it's also fair to say that if we're interested in halting, slowing down, reversing climate change, or we're interested in halting mass atrocities in the Sudan or the Congo, or if we're interested in not repeating the 2008 financial meltdown, that frankly, no group of deals cut by transnational corporations or Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International are going to do the job. One needs to get states to take seriously the commitments they've made and the commitments they have not yet made. And if there are global problems, we need global solutions, not a set of occasional tactical short-term responses instead of sustained and strategic and longer-run global perspectives and actions. And that's why it seems to me that while I'm happy with the energy, the resources, and the energy and resources that are made available by all kinds of non-state actors, at the same time, states are the ones who are ultimately the guarantors of order. They're the ones that sign contracts that are called, international conventions and treaties.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are going to enforce or not enforce human rights, not Human Rights Watch and Amnesty. And it seems to me that part of the proverbial baby has been tossed out here in being excited about everything else. So in the series, to come back to your question, there are hosts of books on rating agencies, Moody's and what have you. There are all kinds of actors related to the transnational investments and finance. We've got a couple of books coming out on these bits and pieces that are important pieces in understanding the way the contemporary world functions. But my own hobby horse these days is to reemphasize the importance of universal global institutions as part and parcel of a future order that will keep us and our children and grandchildren thriving.
This book that we've been hearing some of the details about, that he has co-edited with Dan Plesch, is called We Are Strong, Wartime Origins and the Future United Nations, published by Routledge. Tom, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Heath. Anytime.